can reverse the growing epidemic of chronic childhood illness. And at 11:30, on the radio zine, host Kristen Yount interviews Wendy Dyer about her quilts made from tarpaulins and how they benefit houseless people. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. Not a KABU member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Problem with Privilege, a four-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. This class is for those who want to name and correct liberal racism, who want to understand and interrupt isms, and who want to be a powerful ally and take on race issues and white fragility without co-opting the issues. Again, that's The Problem with Privilege, a four-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. at Hatch, 2420 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Information on how to register for the class and more can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. What if our best intended efforts to protect our children's health were found to be instead one of the primary causes of today's rise in chronic illness? Our guest today, Dr. Maya Sheetreat-Klein, believes that is the case. Dr. Sheetreat-Klein is an integrative pediatric neurologist with a medical degree from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where she was awarded the Edward Padow Award for Excellence in Pediatrics and graduated with a special distinction in research in child neurology for her original work on autism. Dr. Sheetreat-Klein completed the University of Arizona's two-year fellowship in integrative medicine founded by Andrew Weil and is now a member of its faculty. She teaches nationally and internationally at conferences, both for physicians and laypeople, on children's health, autism, integrative medicine, and nutrition, toxins, and neurological health. And she's here today to talk about her new book, The Dirt Cure, a book Dr. Andrew Weil says will turn the prevailing paradigm on its head, one that shows parents how to keep kids healthy by allowing them exposure to microbes. Welcome, Dr. Sheetreat-Klein.
Thank you for having me.
So you begin The Dirt Cure with the idea that the national obsession with oversanitation is one of the main causes of the rise in chronic illness in children. Can you explain this theory to us?
Sure. Well, first I'll say what dirt means in this context. Dirt is microbes or germs. It's healthy food from healthy soil, and it's spending time outdoors in nature. And what we've done in many ways is sort of sanitized our lives and sanitized the lives of children by, first of all, you know, we intervene whenever children have infections. We don't really allow for supporting the body and for convalescing. We sanitize our homes with bleach and our, you know, we have hand sanitizers in every school, in every classroom, and we sanitize their food with pesticides. And keeping them indoors so much more than they used to be. A lot of times in schools now, recess is much shorter. A lot of times kids are actually forbidden recess if one child will misbehave. They're having less PE time and so much more screen time. So in all these different ways, children are just not immersed in the kind of biodiverse dirt that their immune systems, their brains, and even their guts really need in order to be healthy.
Can you point us to some of the suggestive science around this hypothesis? What are some of the things that people are finding that that show us that either using too much hand sanitizer or perhaps too much antibiotics or too much pesticides is leading to the rise in childhood illness?
Sure. You know, for one thing, I'll use bleach as an example. We have this idea that, you know, using bleach means we're cleaner and therefore we're going to be healthier. But there was a large study done in Europe last year, and it showed that children who live in homes or attend schools where bleach is used regularly actually had 20% higher risk of getting the flu or having chronic cough or other illnesses during the winter. So very interesting because, you know, what we perceived was actually kind of the opposite of what was really happening. We also know that children who, I think a lot of people have heard of the hygiene hypothesis, right? That children who live on farms have fewer allergic illnesses, allergies, eczema, asthma, et cetera. And so they said, well, this is probably because they're dirtier and there's more microbes. So what was interesting was that some researchers said, well, let's compare a group of kids in an urban apartment and on a farm. And it turned out that the number of microbes was actually pretty similar, but what was different was the diversity. So when there are many types of microbes, we respond and our immune systems respond in a much more resilient way and are less likely to develop all these different conditions, which are chronic. You know, so it used to be that a child would get sick and have a convalescence and then recover. And now what we're seeing is a lot of children are getting sick, getting a little better, getting sick, getting a little better, and they're kind of in these chronic cycles. So it turns out that it looks from all the research and the growing research that the more microbial and nutritional biodiversity, the more our bodies respond in healthy ways.
So you mentioned that people who live in the city, they're not exposed to less microbes than on the farm, just less diverse variety of microbes. And you mentioned earlier about soil and contact with soil. And I'm presuming that if we're eating food that comes from soil that doesn't have a very diverse microbial life, that perhaps that's also part of the problem. Is that true?
Well, yeah, because it's sort of interesting. This idea of the dirt cure actually works for plants. Plants, part of what's very nutritious about plants, I mean, we think about macronutrients and we think about especially micronutrients like, you know, minerals and vitamins. And what we often don't think about are phytonutrients, which are the things that make cranberries red or, you know, bananas yellow or even coffee bitter. Okay, so all of these sort of phytonutrients are what really give us a lot of the flavor and appearance of the fruit and vegetables we eat. So those exist as the immune system of the plant. And, you know, for example, you know, when there's actually more biodiverse microbes in the soil and even pests, it stimulates the plant to produce more of these phytonutrients to protect it. And those phytonutrients go into our body and have been shown to have impact on everything from preventing cancer to reducing risk of asthma to improving cognition and brain plasticity. So very dramatic things can change in our bodies when we're exposed to higher amounts of those plant phytonutrients, which are high when there's microbial diversity in the soil. What's also interesting is that the microbes from soil themselves impact us. So there's a microbe called Mycobacterium vaccae. And when we're exposed to it through little cuts in our hands, through inhaling it, or even obviously through eating it with our food, or if we're, you know, playing outside and then eat something, it actually boosts serotonin levels in the brain to a similar degree as SSRI antidepressants like Zoloft or Prozac. And in studies, they found in animal studies that the animals were able to perform complex mazes in half the time and with less anxiety when they were exposed to this microbe.
So is there a way, when people are looking for food, what sort of situations should they be looking for to find plants that are higher in phytonutrients and to also plants that are grown in a microbial diverse environment?
Yeah, I think the most nutrient-dense plants actually are probably foraged, meaning wild plants, and people can actually find those kinds of things in their own yards, sometimes like dandelion greens, which are pretty ubiquitous all over the country. So that's, you know, actually probably the most phytonutrient-dense food because nobody's really helping it. And so it's really tough, you know what I mean, in terms of its immune system, very resilient. But for people who are not as interested in doing that, they can go to farmers markets where very often they're going to find actually foraged foods, but also lots of fresh options that are not power washed or coated in waxes or other chemicals that often the foods we find in supermarkets could be. Looking for organic foods because pesticides are obviously influencing the soil microbial content and the kind of pests that these plants might actually see and respond to and become healthier from. And, you know, if you are shopping in a store, looking for biodynamic is actually, or permaculture raised are some of the methods of farming that are actually very clearly focused on being custodians of soil and really nourishing the soil. So those are some suggestions.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Health Watch, and we're talking today to Dr. Maya Shetreat-Klein, the author of The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids with Food Straight from Soil. Well, you mentioned that the tougher plants, the plants that are having to fend because of this, the diversity of microbes and potentially with pests, have a higher nutrient value. But you also talk about how some infections are potentially good for children in terms of developing a resilient immune system. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Sure. I think we're learning a lot very quickly right now in this regard because, you know, even if we're talking about, first of all, just getting a fever, you know, people get very panicked when their children have fevers, and sometimes that's with good reason. If you have a newborn, if you have an immunosuppressed child, or if your child looks very toxic, you know, and looks sick. And so in these cases, you want to get them checked out right away. But many times, you know, you'll take your child to the doctor and they'll say, well, it's a virus. And parents feel they need to really suppress the fever. And part of what they're doing when they suppress the fever is actually suppressing the whole immune inflammatory response as well. And some of the anti-fever medications have actually been shown to cause or be linked to, let's say, I wouldn't say cause, but be linked to other kinds of chronic illness. Tylenol has been linked to developing asthma, for instance, and obviously also carries a risk of having liver issues. And ibuprofen actually has risks related to heart disease. So we're kind of focusing on those things and suppressing the immune system and not allowing children to kind of just to support their bodies and allowing their immune systems to learn for next time. Which makes them stronger. We're also learning now that certain illnesses like mumps, for instance, which used to be pretty ubiquitous, actually seems to reduce the risk of developing ovarian cancer by about half later in life. And so this is sort of an interesting phenomenon because we've thought that viruses were unequivocally bad. And now we're learning that there could be, there are other kinds of examples like that where measles is actually being used now as an oncolytic to kill cancer quite effectively, actually, in very difficult to treat cancers like glioblastoma multiforme and pancreatic cancer. So I think we're kind of starting to reframe what we've been thinking about bacterial infections, about viruses. It doesn't mean that these are all great all the time, obviously. But, you know, it might be a more nuanced story than we originally thought.
Well, if it is indeed more nuanced and complex, how do you coach your patients when, on the one hand, there may be these benefits? On the other hand, we also know that people do die of the flu or from the measles or occasionally from unpasteurized juice, for instance. How do you walk that line of the danger of infection and the health benefits of one?
Well, I think that there are clearly many cases where we can support the body and strength. You know, I think that actually having a really nutrient-dense diet and being exposed to lots of microbes, both through through food and through having small illnesses, does strengthen the immune system. But I also think, you know, that right now the science is very much in flux. So, you know, I try to assess that with the families. I do think, you know, that in general, because the science is changing so quickly, we really have to be assessing, reassessing, and reassessing again the kinds of practices that we're recommending. But, you know, I don't think that I would be making one blanket recommendation.
Right.
Because it's a very fast-changing science right now.
Can you talk about some of the science and some of the stuff you discuss in the Dirt Cure about the importance of children being outside, being in nature, in contact with animals, and otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. In several studies that have been done looking at children spending time in natural settings, it's shown that children actually have better performance on standardized tests when they've spent time outdoors in green space during the day of during their school day. There are also a lot of studies looking at children who are on more natural playgrounds versus less natural playgrounds, and again showing that they're calmer, that they're happier, that they're more focused, and actually more creative in the classroom. So there are some fascinating studies also coming from Japan about something called Shinrin Yoku, which is translated to forest bathing. And what it is essentially immersing yourself in the beauty of the forest. And they use this there as a preventive medicine. It's actually prescribed to patients. And so it's been well studied. And what's been found there is, again, people sleep better, their cortisol levels are lower, so they're less stressed, they're happier, they have better mood, and better focus, including executive function, and they have lower inflammatory markers and higher anti-cancer protein. So there are so many ways that nature is actually kind of reaching into our bodies and influencing everything from our immune system to our brain.
Hmm. Well, talk to us a little bit more about the diet that you propose in the Dirt Cure. What are some of the premier foods that are part of the diet?
Well, one of the things that I wanted to do with the book was, you know, I feel like there's always something coming up saying, you know, almonds are good. No, almonds are horrible, you know, and everything seems to be one day good, one day bad. And I think what I wanted to kind of give people a little bit of a bird's eye view, as well as a lot of tips and kind of hands-on information, just so that they could not have to kind of go which way the wind blows every other day and have a sense that the key is to eat diverse, fresh foods that are as unprocessed as possible. And that's really the key, knowing where it comes from as well, and knowing where the animals are coming from, how they're raised, and how things are processed. And so I give a lot of information about that. One of the key things, especially for animal products, is that they should be raised in the way they're meant to be, which is outdoors on pasture. So one of the things I recommend highly are eggs, especially with the yolks. We've had a kind of national demonization of cholesterol, and actually it turns out it was not really well-founded in terms of it being a problem related to eggs. And so people who eat about 5 eggs a week live longer than people who eat under 1 egg, 1 egg or less per week. And cholesterol is actually so critical in the developing brain that there are special enzymes in breast milk that help to break it down and absorb it. So, and in the brain, actually, although it's only 3% of body mass, it has about 25% of the body's cholesterol. So eggs, I think, are critical. And also they have choline, which is another element very important for brain development and memory. And I have parents who come to me still and say, oh, well, we only do egg white omelets. So, I always say yolks are like liquid gold. And that, it should be very, it should be part of every child's diet. Another thing I recommend are bitters. So that sounds, I think, to a lot of parents like not something their children would eat, but bitters are actually found in dark chocolate. They're found in chamomile tea and some other teas. They're found in fruit and vegetable peels. So, a lot of parents will peel the apple, but actually those bitter compounds, slightly bitter, in the apple peel are doing all kinds of things in the body to promote health, including stimulating gut motility. So that helps with things like heartburn, helps with things like constipation, bloating, gas. It also stimulates stomach acid, so that it helps us to break down and digest our food better. It stimulates the digestive immune system, which is helpful to prevent things like gastroenteritis and like those vomiting, diarrhea, dreaded infections. And interestingly, we don't just have all of these bitter receptors throughout the digestive tract, but we also have it on the pancreas, so it helps stabilize blood sugar levels. And it's in the ear, nose, throat, and lungs. So bitters actually stimulate the immune system there, which prevent things like flu and, colds. And it's actually being looked at now as a treatment for asthma.
And you walk people through in the Dirt Cure a way to help figure out what kids might be allergic to, food allergies being one of the things that have risen over the years in incidence among children. What is your preferred method of figuring out food allergies?
Yeah, that's a great question because, it can be really challenging. I think a lot of people will do, blood tests or skin tests, with doctors. But I think sometimes it's possible to look at what a child's eating. And I would say I want to make a comment that there's no test that is 100% to help determine if a child has an allergy or a sensitivity, particularly a sensitivity. We're not very good at detecting that. So we're reasonable at finding out about allergies, and I always recommend looking in the blood, not just skin. And we're reasonable about being able to find to detect celiac, which is an autoimmune condition where people react to gliadin or, gluten, an element of gluten. But sometimes their kids will eat one particular food very obsessively, And paradoxically, that can sometimes be a food that bothers them. So if they have, you know, let's say eczema, chronic constipation, or asthma, or they had reflux as a baby, or they have chronic ear infections, I often will look to dairy products as a likely culprit, particularly if that child is pretty dairy obsessed. And that would be like cheese and milk and yogurt and ice cream. So what I always recommend if we're, you know, going to be investigating in this way is to really do an 100% elimination for 1 month. And it should only be a trial, because we don't want to remove foods that are perfectly healthy for someone and that are not causing issues for them, particularly children, because they need, you know, as I said, diverse foods that are nutrient dense. So 1 month should always give enough information. And if parents don't notice a change, then reintroducing it for a weekend and then looking, you know, stopping and kind of seeing if anything flares is the other element. So elimination for 1 month and then reintroduction. And that's really the way that I recommend detecting food reactivity. And I talk about in the book as well some of the more significant kinds of reactivities that might not be specifically allergy. But, you know, there are some cases where children really don't tolerate grains well. And that is usually in more severe conditions. For instance, Crohn's disease, where they are investigating actually at, I think, Seattle Children's now, you know, the SCD, specific carbohydrate diet, which is fairly grain-free for Crohn's disease in children.
And you had an experience with your own son and his asthma that had a link to, ended up having a link to food in the end, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, my son had, you know, been developing pretty nicely. He had reacted a little bit to dairy. You know, he was a breastfed baby, but because I was working occasionally, he was supplemented with formula. And when he was supplemented with dairy formula, he had, you know, like gas and seemed uncomfortable. So we gave him a supplement of soy formula, which he seemed to tolerate. And then around a year of age, he started to break out in rashes and started to have, actually on his first birthday, these episodes of breathing problems, which appeared as asthma. And we spent 10 months of him being sick basically almost all the time. So he might be like well for a few days, then he would have a runny nose, and he would start kind of with these asthma-like symptoms. And the medication didn't really help him very much, and our doctor was giving him, you know, really what he gave for kids in these situations, which was a combination of steroids and antibiotics, which in the end, I believe, actually made him quite a bit sicker. What we recognized about 10 months out, when I was kind of realizing nobody had answers and people just said, you know, oh, he's just kind of a reactive kid, this is the way it's going to be, was we needed to figure out if he was reacting to a food. And indeed, I finally was able to find a doctor who would do, they just did regular skin testing as allergists do, and found he was severely allergic to soy, which he'd been getting at that point in the form of soy milk because he was older. And when we stopped the soy, all soy in his diet, within 3 days, he stopped having any breathing issues.
And do you have a website you can point our listeners to or other resources online?
Yeah, my website is actually dirtcure.com. And, you know, I have there a lot of information and, you know, more that I'm adding about different aspects of the book. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and posting lots of current scientific articles and other information about, you know, things like fracking and what's happening with GMO labeling and a lot of the other issues that I think we often don't link to directly, at least to children's health problems or our health problems, but are definitely part of the picture as well.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
We're talking today to author and pediatric neurologist Maya Shetreat-Klein about her latest book, The Dirt Cure, Growing Healthy Kids from Food Straight from Soil. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
KBOO at your fingertips, anywhere you happen to be with our new mobile app. Look up KBOO, K-B-O-O, in iTunes or Google Play to download the free KBOO mobile app. The app has many features, including listening controls in case you need to rewind back to something you missed. Want to know what's happening on KBOO's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram accounts? You can find it all on the app, along with our community events, calendar, newsletters, and more. The KBOO mobile app is the easiest way to connect with your favorite shows on your mobile phone. Download it from iTunes or Google Play today.
Mass incarceration in the United States is due in part to the criminalization of people with drug addictions. Join me on Prison Pipeline March 21st to hear Leland Berger, an attorney who defends those charged with cannabis-related crimes. He'll discuss the recent legalization of marijuana and its effects on the criminal justice system here in Oregon.